you know, we do what we do.
We do what we do. We do what we do. I like that. All right, JK, if we do what we do, how are you doing and where are you?
I am in India, in Bangalore. I just touched down actually yesterday. Today's episode is sponsored by Data.ai. To access estimates for rankings, downloads, revenue, usage, or engagement for millions of apps on the App Store and Google Play, sign up for Data.ai. I don't know. How are you doing?
I've been following you on Instagram, and things have not been as peachy on like a health wise. Like you've gotten injured playing football for the for the Americans soccer, which is not a plus 40-year-old should be playing. And I know that in your latest flight, I mean your flights from San Francisco to Bangalore, how horrible are they?
They're pretty bad, right? Because we also fly economy.
but not the last flight. Last flight, you flew.
I got a free upgrade from that. It's a premium economy.
Exactly. So, anyway, I was happy for you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's actually a kind of a big difference on Emirates. But yeah, it's you know, we do what we need to do as a startup. We got to be cheap. Got to be frugal. Got to do what we need to do.
Yeah. So I wanted to, so just like a background for this recording, like we've been talking about doing a recording for quite some while. And of course I was working at a corporation, so it's a little bit of a challenging to do any kind of a free flowing, recordings, as anybody can understand, you're a representative of a company. So that makes totally sense. The first podcast that I really wanted to do is with you because we kind of started this, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We're the OGs of this nonsense. and a lot
and
of
now
things
everyone's
have happened.
Got a podcast now.
Now everybody's got a podcast, but you know, people forget what the biggest one is. But anyways, don't. And so you know, we've kind of went through our own paths, but still kept in touch. And I kind of wanted to return back to the podcast with returning it with you, with the OG of gaming podcasts, Mr. JK. And the format for this, I thought what would be really fun is I ask you three questions. You ask me three questions. And it's like a 3v3 type of a setup because I don't want to do an interview. You don't want to do an interview. We just want to banter. So this is like a more sophisticated way to banter. So I wanted to start off with you and kind of like following your story on Instagram and, you know, sending messages here and there. It's been rough, like mentally, health-wise, like any startup. But you have the added challenges of working with a team in Bangalore. So you have a team that is, first of all, far away, and secondly, probably very different type of a culture. So I wanted to kind of see, firstly, from your perspective, is like, how do you balance your life? How are you able to be a dad of three, have a family in San Francisco, and at the same time have a studio in Bangalore and the co-founders and the venture funding and the collapse of mobile gaming and all the nonsense that you can read from the news? Like how do you do that? The long travels and so forth.
Yeah. So the secret to this is actually something I call working smarter. No, I'm just kidding. So
you work like a horse.
I work a lot. I don't think any level of work. And by the way, this is something I've been told a lot, right? Because you know, throughout my career, I've met a bunch of people, and you know, when I tell them how much I work, they would say, "Oh yeah, that's great for you. I just work smarter," and I've never been able to like crack that code myself where. And maybe there are people out there who just work smarter than me, but for me, I feel like I have to figure out how to work smarter, and that's a work in progress. But I also think for me, I haven't figured out a way of being able to achieve success without a hard work ethic. And so, to your point on balance, I actually don't balance, and I also am of the belief, you know, there's a lot of it's kind of like this notion that anything that's very valuable does require sacrifice. And that's kind of what I'm doing now is that, you know, do I like having to come out? And at this point, you know, I'm spending half my time here, half my time in the US with my family. You know, it's tough. It's very tough. Family does not appreciate it. You know, there are some things I'm going to miss out on in terms of, you know, spending time with the family and things like that. But also, I just think, and this is something I've talked about on other podcasts, but like, for me, it's just like about personal choice, where at least at this point in my life and being an older guy, it's, I feel like my time is kind of running out, where I'm only going to have so many years of trying to do something productive or to try to achieve something meaningful in my life, where, you know, and it all comes back to this, this essay from Clayton Christensen, who wrote this essay, which had a, you know, pretty profound impact in how I think about my life. It's called, you know, how do you measure your life? And so for me, I think in those terms, and, you know, Jeff Bezos talked about this as well, Clayton Christensen, you know, on your deathbed, when you look back on your life, you know, how would you value your life, or what metrics would you consider that you've lived a life well lived? And for me, I'm the kind of guy who, you know, like, if you gave me $10 billion or even $10 million or, you know, like, my costs are so low. Like, you know, I put so much down on my house, and I bought it such a long time ago. Like, my, and like, what I do for entertainment is like, I just, it's hard for me to spend money. So my motivation has never been about like making a ton of money, because, you know, that's just not important for me. So for me, I sacrifice and I work hard because I'm trying to do something that I think will, that I will be proud of, you know, when it comes to that time later in my life. And I think about, have I lived a life well lived? I'm trying to try and do something so that I can be proud of my life at that point.
So you said many very interesting things. First of all, this sounds like a midlife crisis, but it's not. You've been always like this.
life crisis.
This is a life crisis. It also sounds like a very Korean work ethic. I have a lot of Korean friends, and sure, guys work incredibly hard. It's you put everybody else to shame. But I wanted to kind of like dive in deeper into, like, you said something that makes you proud. But there's plenty of things to be proud of, like both in your personal life of being a dad, of having this really beautiful family that you have, as well as the element of, like, you know, what I think about is like having a greater life or purpose. And part of that has to be contributing to the world more than you are taking from it. And right, you are doing that. Like, you are sharing a lot of information. You're a very helpful person. You're creating jobs, although in India, but still, yeah, not in the great US, but you are giving a lot of back, and there's a lot of things to be proud of. But what do you, like, what is that thing that would make you proud of? Is it opinion of somebody of the gaming industry, or what is that? That's type of a thing that you think.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way that I think about it is, in one of the ways in which a lot of people think about companies is really having a product orientation, right? Which is, okay, so one way you can think about a company is as the organization and the product. Mm-hmm. And the way that most companies are oriented is primarily having a product focus. You know, a lot of complexity, a lot of thinking about how do we improve the product. And I feel just generally, and in my experience, there has been less focus on the organization, meaning the processes and the people. And so for me, meaning and kind of where I think I can add more value is by trying to build an organizationally oriented type of company, one that mm-hmm. really looks at the people. And, you know, I think for me, meaning would be creating opportunities for people and then trying to figure out ways in which people can change. Because that's one fundamental premise that I have, is that I totally realize, and I've talked to many people who have argued with me a lot about the ability for people to improve and change at organizations. And it's a very difficult problem, but I think it's one in which change can, in my belief, change can happen. Now, I do agree that for the vast majority of people, change is difficult and comes very slowly. But, you know, I'm trying to get to a point where we can build a company that provides opportunities for people, and the people that we do bring in, we're able to change them for the better, to increase their personal value, because ultimately it's the organization that builds the product. So if you improve the people that make the product, then the product should follow. That's kind of like the philosophy that I'm taking.
Yeah, it's a very mature way of thinking. I definitely did not have this way of thinking, but I'm kind of like getting closer to that of putting the organization first over the product, because I've mostly put in always the product in front of the organization until you realize that you have to have the organization to make the product, or at right. least they have to be in sync. And the better organization you have, the more flexible you are to pursue different type of a product goals. But and the last part about this one is, like, you talked a lot about sacrificing, and I think sacrificing is naturally a part of any kind of a journey. If you want to get somewhere, you have to sacrifice, whether you sacrifice right. your personal life, whether you sacrifice your health, be it physical or mental, it's just a part of that journey. I don't think you will get anywhere without sacrifice. But right. how do you evaluate the size of a sacrifice to the potential gain? Because I know you've sacrificed a lot. Like, you've sacrificed everything from a cushy job in LA down to time with your family, which is something you can never get back, and something that I right. always think about when yep. kids. Like, how do you say, like, this is the right size of a sacrifice that I'm doing right now? And do you second guess the sacrifices you're making?
For any specific person, it will be situational. And for me, I do think there are limits, right? So there was a period about 2 weeks when I was in the US where I was taking calls like up until like 2-3 a.m. And then my kids would wake me up early in the morning. So like I thought I probably did have some kind of a stroke or something during that time. It was just really not healthy. I think there are limits where you have to push back and not sacrifice too much. And, you know, we have something that we call an overarching rule at our company, which we just call common sense rules, meaning, like, for any specific rule or process or whatever we have at the company, just use common sense. If it doesn't make sense, don't do it. And so for me too, sometimes if things get too far, like at that time where I really felt like I was like, well, you know, if I have a stroke and I'm brain dead, then I'm not going to do the company much good. So I then like reorganize my schedule a little bit and try to do some things where, you know, I'm exercising more and doing things where I can get better sleep. So I do think it can go far. But I would say the specific, you know, questions around, well, do I spend more time with my family right now? Or, you know, do I extend my trip? You know, one of the things for this trip was just speaking to my wife about, you know, can we reduce the amount of time? You know, it's already reduced from spending 3 months in India to 1 month in the US to 2-2. But like, yeah, I think for every person, they've just got to figure out for themselves what makes the most sense. And there are definitely trade-offs. And I do think that that's the concept, I think, of trade-offs is important, because there are too many people who believe they can just have it all, right? And so the very nature of a startup is lack of resources. And the fact that you can't do everything is actually, in my opinion, a good thing. And I do think, just on the personal level, thinking about what's important to you and realizing what is it worth, and then when you do sacrifice, it becomes clear, right? And it's important too. So like, there's a lot of things because of the sacrifice you can do that you wouldn't be able to do. And so a lot of the relationships that I have with my co-founders and the way in which we operate have been through a process of a lot of difficult conversations and honest discussions and things like that, where, you know, I couldn't be happier in terms of where we are as a company and the relationships that I have with my co-founders, but that took, I think, having certain conversations and getting to a certain point where things happen in the company or you're stressing things, mm-hmm. you know, it requires, because you've sacrificed, you're going to have those conversations and things like that. And so I just want to highlight that, you know, trade-offs and sacrifice isn't necessarily bad. And in some cases, and in the startup case, I think is actually an important part of the startup process in order to be successful.
Yeah, it's necessary. All right, your turn to ask a question.
All right. Okay, so the question I have for you really has to do with your entrepreneurial journey. And so to some degree, you've kind of had the kind of outcome that some people would dream of. You know, you started a company, you built it up, able to found the initial team, acquired by Sony, which for some people is like the ultimate in terms of, you know, like when you think about gaming and things like that. And so I wanted to ask you about your journey and if you can talk about your greatest highlight and your greatest low light from your experience. How would you talk about that?
Well, this is something that I tell the people, like the sentence that I used is like, the result is not indicative of the path. So I think there's a lot of variables that goes into these things. So kind of going into the beginning, like when I started my entrepreneurial journey, I remember when you started your startup and I was telling you like, what are you doing? Like, why are you starting startup? Just live the cushy executive life. Like, that's the way to go. I think I told you and your wife about this, like stop this guy, like when you're in Helsinki. And then something happened where I just wanted to do the same thing. I remember we were, me and my co-founder were working at Rovio and he just recently joined and we were having just like a 101 and he asked me like, what are you doing here? I was like, I was a head of studio. He's like, you don't belong here. It's like, and you know, he is a very much like me, like very excitable person. And then we just started talking about like what kind of an organization, what kind of a company we would build and what kind of games would be making. And then we found something that was very interesting and that kind of led to really quickly in picking up steam and moving ahead with building a company. And this was just before COVID. And then we started the company the moment COVID hit, when we went home. That's when we actually raised funding. So in my head, the starting of my own company would have been as simple as it was at FunPlus. So we both worked at FunPlus. I was heading the San Francisco studio, kind of building it from the ground up, the team. It was the best job I have ever had. It was the most smooth sailing I ever had, because hindsight, what had happened is, you know, our team at Zynga had kind of like evaporated. We had a failed project that was a very long, the team changed multiple times. It was like one of those difficult projects. And I went to FunPlus and I wanted to start a team from the beginning, kind of learn how to build teams properly, because it was such a difficult process at a bigger corporation where there was so much changes. And the people who came, I think our team was like 80-85% ex-Zynga, especially from the studio that I was working with. And I didn't have to invest at all into organization, into culture, into everything, because we had the shared memories. And what we wanted to do, what we had, is like, let's not do what we did there. For example, we didn't do specs much. We just whiteboarded. And everything that was happening, like everything was so easy. Making games was so easy. Pivoting was so easy. It was a pleasure working. It was almost like actually my 8-hour work days. I came in at 9 and I left at like 5, 6. It was kind of like done. We didn't have much meetings because like, so, you know, we had a lot of meetings, and then here we didn't want to have any meetings. So it was like very focused, very easy. And so in my head, I was like, this is how we're going to work. Like, this is starting a studio is so easy. Getting a functional studio is so easy. And what happened was like when my journey started, there was like some changes in the co-founding team. Like, we were supposed to be much more Rovio focused, but then there were some, you know, like not every people jumps when you say jump from the plane. Yeah. And what ended up happening is that the team that was supposed to jump was not exactly the team that jumped. And so the co-founders were a little bit different than initially anticipated, and that brought a lot of challenges. Like, now you're working with people who you haven't worked before and you're starting a company. Then there was another challenge of COVID, like the overall stress, if you can remember the 2020, when we didn't know how dangerous this disease was. Like, we were like, this is a Spanish flu type of a thing. Wasn't quite that, dangerous, but not quite as dangerous as we assumed in the beginning. But at that point, I, as everybody else, we're stressed out. Like, are we going to die? Am I going to get sick? And we were going to the office as a startup, like even in the beginning, before the flu, before the vaccines, before everything, we were going to the studio, just spending time together and working together, because that's important in the beginning. And then when the mandates of like, you can't come to work, and now there's the English version, the South African version, and the Indian version, and the moon version, whatever the versions came in, they kind of like clamped down that the people should work remotely. And also our team was growing. It wasn't just the co-founders, it was now employees, and we couldn't mandate them to come. And we moved into a remote work with a relatively new team. And that created a lot of challenges, a lot of stress, a lot of communication issues. Also, there was no travel. At some point, because we started, again, like more challenges, we started from a location in Berlin and in Helsinki at the same time, because half of the co-founders were coming in from Berlin. And when there was no, like when they stopped travel at like towards the end of 2020, we couldn't meet each other face to face. So that brought, again, the communication challenges. And then, of course, there's the fundraising that in the beginning was difficult. And then there was the Web3 craze, where I remember being at Slush and even talking about what we're doing. It felt like I was pitching a board game company. People were like, what are you talking about, mobile games? It's all about non-fungibles and like NFTs and crypto. It's like, get out of here with your mobile games. That wasn't like 2021, and you were laughed out of room if you were making anything else than Web3, and then there was the IDFA collapse, and then people were like, well, no, we're not really into mobile, we're going to do PC and Steam and so forth. So that was a challenge. And then on a personal journey, I had my second child. We had our second child in 2021. I think, early, right. So somewhere around that. She's two now. Yes, 2021. And then again, like doing a funding round while you have a newborn, it was, as you said, like there's not much sleep, there's a lot of stress, there's a lot of this, there's a lot of that. And then you jump on a call with an investor, you have to smile, you have to be confident, you have to be, you know, oozing everything good, and then you haven't really slept, you have a baby, you have a challenges of communication, of having that nonlinear progress that I was used to at FunPlus. All these elements were very challenging. So overall, my entrepreneurial path and story is quite short. But it was a roller coaster, like every entrepreneurial story, I think. And when you ask about like the highlights and the low moments, well, the highlights in that roller coaster, they came in quite often. Like it could be signing a new person, like a lead designer or an artist or anything. As you know, from your experience, like signing somebody to join your company, you're so excited. I still remember like the times, like I would go to a gym in the evening after we signed somebody. It's like, you know, you put in your name on the DocuSign, like that person signed, we text each other, like we got this guy or we got her. And you feel so great because somebody joined your company. You know that person is going to propel you forward. Raising funds is always exciting, and kind of getting things signed, like crossing those milestones is great, or having a good play test. Even that is a highlight when the whole team is like excited what they're playing. And then the low moments are just as common or even more common, because, you know, somebody leaves your company. You're like, oh my God, we lost somebody. How can we get this person back and so forth? Or how can we replace this person? There's interpersonal challenges that especially are exaggerated by remote work. Writing, video calls, they're not the same as spending the time together and building that social capital and you know, having the nuance in your communication. So that's a huge thing. You know, getting no's from VCs. I also got some of those as well, especially on the subsequent rounds where they were looking at something else. That puts a lot of stress on you because you are running against the clock, and that clock is the money you have in your account. And just having that nonlinear progress, meaning that the build is not getting better every time. Sometimes it gets worse. And in a situation where you're working, you know, that's problem solving. But when you're an entrepreneur, that every feeling is exaggerated, and that, you know, it's an emotional roller coaster and doesn't always bring the best in you. So that was it. But But in terms of highlights, as you mentioned, like, of course, the final part of Independent Savage was joining PlayStation, and it felt like arriving to a port, as you said. Like, for me as well, like, it's a company that I continue to look up to. Like, it's mm-hmm. I mean, come on, PlayStation. I have PlayStation 5 here at home. It's just like, yep. It's amazing to even consider that I've worked at this company and being able to contribute to the future of it in what no matter how small way. It's part of our old childhood. It's you know, it's crazy to even think about it. Sure. The way it felt that you know, in terms of a highlight, it felt almost like arriving to a port, because at the time we joined, there was a war. It was the inflation, the economy, like, I think the stock market plummeted at some point again, all these type of things that cause extra stress to you. The funding market was kind of like, you know, clamped down. It felt like we can continue. It felt that we can now build on a more stable ground. There was no, like, the next VC or next fundraising round. It's more like, now we can focus on building the organization. We can focus on building the games, and we can focus on really maturing the company. So even after, like, joining, things calmed down so quickly. There was no, you know, that existential threat at every corner. We started, you know, we hired people like Sophie Vo and a lot of others, like, amazing people started joining the company. Not that we didn't have amazing people before, but the funnel just increased. And when we had a lot more people who felt that it's now a company they can join because it's more mature, it's more safer as a place of employment. And all those, you know, felt really fulfilling. And I was, you know, very happy of how things were going. So that's I would say that's naturally the biggest highlight and sort of like a culmination of this relatively short roller coaster ride.
All right, so it was worth it.
Yeah. So that's a great question. Is it worth it? Because what I ask, you know, I've invested in quite a few companies as well, and I love helping founders. In the beginning, like, you always have to have a why of, like, why are you doing this? And then, you know, people say, like, oh, I want to make the games that I want to make, or I want to make a lot of money or whatnot. Like, first of all, I asked them to be truthful to, like, what is your why? And my why was very clear. So before I started this company, I think there's, like, still these Iron Source articles that I wrote about founding teams or whatnot. And they asked me to write about it. And I was writing about, like, setting up a founding team and what makes it good and so forth. And it felt that I'm writing about something I have no idea of, which is true. And something that is my why is, like, I really love helping, you know, other smart people in our industry. And mm-hmm. I felt that when I was, whether I was, you know, doing M&A type of a stuff, meeting founders, or whether I was investing, I couldn't connect with a founder properly. Like, I could talk about product, I could talk about market, I could give them insight, but I really didn't understand their thinking. And my biggest why was, like, I knew that I want to help companies at scale. And I said, you know, I said that to myself, that I need to walk at least 5 steps in the shoes of a founder to really be able to help. And that was my main why. And the secondary why was, of course, I would like to see financial gain. I think you're crazy if you're a founder that is not putting any kind of financial gain, unless you've exited multiple times before, in your target. So first and foremost, learning of experiencing what it is to be a founder, what it is to raise funds, how that process goes, not just reading about it, but actually getting through it to be able to then help other founders. Like, I think I've invested in, like, 16 companies. And then secondary, if everything goes well, there's a small chance. I was prepared to go bankrupt because that's what normally happens to a startup. And I said, like, well, if there's a chance to see any kind of financial gain, because you're losing a lot of money when you're starting a startup. You're going from a well-paid job to actually paying yourself less than I was paid in my first gaming job 13 years before the company. And that kind of plays a little bit of a mental game to you. It's like, mm-hmm. your income just collapses and you're like, I'm actually, like, working poor right now while being a CEO. And so of course, like, having some kind of a financial gain out of that is definitely a target, but I don't think it should be, I mean, somebody could have it as a primary target, but it's a very challenging one because most likely your startup is going to die. So my why was definitely to learn, and I'm very happy that I achieved the why. I can help better the founders.
Awesome. All right, I guess we completed our first question.
Wow, that took a long time.
One by one done out of three by three.
With the other ones are going to go faster, but let me ask you, like, so you asked me about the trials and tribulations. What have been the hardest part of your journey thus far? And especially what I'm asking is like something you didn't expect.
Okay. Well, I would say the hardest part of the startup for me so far, actually, the hardest part is getting a operationally efficient and effective team. So getting like one of the things that I've worked in, for people that don't know, I've worked in publishing for a lot of years, both at Sega and NBC. I've been able to visit a lot of companies. And one of the things that I have noticed is that the companies that have worked or the teams that have worked together for 4 years together before are dramatically more efficient and effective. And the percentage of positive outcomes of successful projects is dramatically higher. So to your point, Mishka, about having experience building a team from scratch, building new teams, that is a difficult process. That is actually one of the hardest parts of this job right now, is getting the team to a point where it is efficient and effective against it, the product type. And for us, shooters is, as you probably know, and when I started, I didn't think it was going to be as hard as it is. And now it's like, oh shit, yeah, shooters is freaking hard. And so the hard part about the startup is getting this team, especially against a very challenging genre of game, a type of game, to be really effective and efficient and to have the kind of team that can really build great products against that genre. And so that's one. I think the second part has been something that we touched upon more on the sacrifice side, the impact to family and my health, just trying to keep that going. And then I think the third part that's been more along the aspect of your question about something that I didn't expect is really, I don't want to get political, and I don't want people to hate me, but I will say that I believe that the notion of liberalism is kind of dying off, meaning, you know, having very, you know, open to new ideas and different ways of working and things like that. But I will say, like, I have had a lot of resistance and pushback and even messages or emails starting with like, fuck you, whereas it's like, okay, because of things around, because we're pretty open about what we believe in, and we don't want to like suggest that that's the only way to work. But for us, you know, we believe in a hard work culture. We don't believe in remote work. For us, for what we're doing, kind of 0-to-1 game development, for what we're trying to do. And, you know, the other thing that's so surprising to me is, and I do live in Silicon Valley, but if you are a fan of Elon Musk, that is like kind of a no-no. And you have a newsletter too, Mishka, but like, I think I've written 2 posts on Elon or Twitter, and after every one, I've lost like 75 subscribers. But every Elon one will dip us down a bit. But yeah, so that to me is a surprising part, right? Is the part where I would like just kind of like the criticisms and attacks from people, or the mischaracterizations of our company because they don't like what we're saying or they don't agree with it. And I would just, you know, the surprising thing, the hard part is just like, it could be easy if we could just have, you know, open discussion and debate. Hey, I believe in this and these are the reasons why. And, you know, I respect, you know, dude, I have fully respect work-life balance. I have a lot of friends that have, well, not now, but have worked at Zynga or want work-life balance. And I think that's totally fine. But like, I think the perspective of like, and I have been told this, you must embrace work-life balance for your company. by, you know, head of HR at another gaming studio, or like, what you're doing is absolutely wrong. You're evil. You're this, you're that. And so that's the part where, you know, it's just like, you know, I mean, to some degree, I don't care what people say or think, but to some degree you do, like, kind of both. But yeah.
So, when the attacks turn personal, or saying you're a fucking idiot, or you know, you're doing everything wrong, like that's yeah. not constructive. I've worked with people, and I know people who are like the Elon Musk haters or Bezos haters or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know who Elon Musk, like, I know who Elon Musk is. I don't know him personally. I don't find his podcast very interesting. I kind of skip them. I think he's too slow a speaker. But of course, I respect the person. Like, look what he's done. And so, like, if the conversation starts with you personally attacking some incredibly successful executive, like, no matter what you want to put it, what he's done and whatnot, he is one of the most successful executives and founders or company leaders that has ever lived. Period. Like, objectively. Yeah. Whether you like his leadership style, whether you like what he's done, he makes spaceships. His companies make spaceships, electric cars, social media, tunnels, flamethrowers. Like, stop. Like, if your argument starts with this guy being a fucking idiot, then I have nothing to listen from you, because you're not an objective person. You can't go over your emotions. Anything that you say, you know, quite frankly, doesn't move me anywhere. So that's just like a hate speech almost.
Yeah. Now, I would say, so living in Silicon Valley, the so many people, there are a lot of people who hate Elon, and I try to understand why and where it's coming from, but I just wish more people would be that way for more things, whether it's, and just be more accepting of, okay, let's agree to disagree, but I understand why you feel that way. Fine.
It's confirmative thinking. That's the problem. They hate him because you're supposed to hate him in this community. Right.
To make this specifically about Elon, but it's just like, I just wish for a world with lots of diversity in terms of approach, in terms of, it's like a lot of different
diversity
kinds of
mind. Diversity of mind. I love having that conversation.
Right. And just similar to like how I would not want to, like, I wouldn't try to tell someone who has work-life balance or who wants it, you must work all the time. You must sacrifice. I wouldn't do that. But then similarly, I wish those people would then say, okay, I get it. You want to sacrifice. You want to do some other things. Cool. All right. I mean, that's your choice. But a world with many different kinds of environments where then the person can then choose different paths for themselves, and they can make that choice for themselves. I want to do this, or no, wait a minute, I want to do this, instead of just eliminating all the choices and saying, here is what everybody must do. And I fear for our world and for the kind of discussions that are occurring where it's like, no, you have to do it this way.
Yes. Especially like, I have this thing of like, you know, being born in Soviet Union and being like very anti-com. No. Okay, I'm anti-communist. I'm sorry. It's like, I think everybody, whether they come from Cuba or whether they come from ex-Soviet Union countries, like, they have this sort of a thing against that sort of a communism. Communism, in a lot of ways, like, what we feel is like that was very confirmative thinking. Like, you were supposed to think and feel and act a certain way. There was nothing. There was no nuances. There's only one party, and you have to toe the party line. And so I get this allergy of like, I'm supposed to think this way. I'm supposed to act this way. And I'm like, wait a minute, whoa. No, this is a free country. I need to form my own opinion. Give me the data and I will form it. I want to understand the nuances. Personal attacks, I don't know. I've had some personal attacks, but I really don't care, to be honest. Like, I've had people to kind of like mischaracterize me who don't know me. I have some people who have never talked to me, but I go back to my army experience where the captain always said, if you're a great leader, 20% will fucking hate your guts. Like, remember that. But as long as the 80% think you're a good dude, you're doing amazing. You can't do better. And I was like, okay, that person goes into the 20%.
That's one of the other things too about the new world and society that we live in. I mean, one of the things, like, I don't post a lot on Twitter, although I do read more on Twitter, but like, you could be Mother Teresa, you know what I'm saying? And at a certain level of scale, you're just going to get hate. It doesn't matter who you are. Someone's going to find
20%.
Someone's going to find some reason to hate you, and they're just going to hate you no matter who you are, no matter how, what, if you're like the perfect person. So
But I think that's the point. I think that they say that in Joe Rogan's podcast. He will say it's like nobody who's successful is a hater. though I do have to say, I have some haters that are quite successful. So he's not right.
Your turn. So maybe not, although I guess we're focusing a lot on your startup experience, but maybe the second question from my side would be the biggest lesson that you've learned. Mm-hmm. So given this whole, you know, full cycle in terms of starting a company, selling it, what was the biggest lesson that you've learned? And maybe just as an add-on part to that question, if there was anything during the period of the startup that you could do over again, what would it have been?
So starting from the second part, what would you do over? I think everything. I feel like I'm kind of self-criticizing as you are. Like I always feel that there could be better. I suck at celebrating anything that I've done. Anyways, but let me go in a more detail. So in terms of like learnings, I would say like five things that are really really come to my mind. The number one is the role of market research. So it has, you know, it was really, really helpful for us since the beginning. And, you know, I would consider myself pretty good in market research, predicting trends, writing about that. So being able to kind of like position ourselves pre-product market fit proof, but having that thesis and using a lot of tools, like we used GeekLab, we used Solsten to really dive deep. We used Playtest Cloud, all these tools to kind of convince internally us that we're doing the right things, convince the people who would be joining the company that we're on the right path, as well as convince the VCs and the different partners that this is the right thing to be doing. So market research has been really, really crucial, and that's what I would push any startup to focus on. Is like that is your thesis, and use as many tools as possible to really solidify it. The number two is something that you've mentioned, and I think this is with anything, is that is building a stellar team. You know, I don't remember which, I was going through this. I think it was Google's Game Camp training for startups early on, and they had some speaker. Again, I totally forgot the person's name, so sorry about that. But this person was a former founder, you know, successful and so forth. He was saying that building a team is value creation. So as you're able to show that your team is growing with either high profile, preferably high profile hires, that is creating a value. And so that is a very important aspect, especially if you're a startup CEO, if you're part of a leadership team, is like, how can you attract that person into your team? Because it shows a very, very positive signal. As a person from Rockstar joins you, or Supercell, or King, like what kind of a games you're making, and a person from a benchmark company comes into your team, that shows that that you could be one of the future best. So investing time in getting those people into your company is incredibly important, and it is value creation. The second part is, of course, scaling smartly. So it's very easy to move too fast. It's very easy to overpay. And it's very easy to hire those specialists from different companies who are far away and might not fit your culture, your values, your virtues. So kind of like really being measured with hiring is imperative for any company, because a mistake in hiring is such a massive mistake. Because if the person doesn't fit or is the not one, you have to reopen position. You have to pay. Sometimes you use a recruiter. So you've invested a lot of time from your team in onboarding this person, interviewing this person, and training this person, and getting them online, blah, blah, blah. So it's like the cascading effect of a wrong hire is surmountable. So having a very thorough, not only budget thinking, but also foundational thinking of what kind of people are going to be successful in your company and how you can make sure that they will stay is crucial. Those will be the biggest cost that you will incur is with scaling, and especially the wrong scaling. And the second part is, of course, as you're a small team, go for generalist. Go for people who have open mindset of outsourcing, of using an AI, because you can also hire people who are who would be joining from larger companies that would be like, I don't like AI. It's like, okay, well, we're a startup. We need to do whatever we can to show progress, to move forward. It's like, we have to use AI. And if they are categorically against these type of things that are considered as shortcuts, then that's, for example, a wrong hire that would slow down the whole team and create that sort of a counterculture. Number three would be the power of networking. So as people say, your network is your net worth. I read a lot of posts by Joachim and others who are saying, like, don't go to GDC, don't go to, just focus, sit in your little studio or from home and work on your product. That's important for sure. But it's equally important to have those networks. It's very important to meet up the VCs, the different strategic partners, other companies, talk to them, share information, really build your network. Because that will help you in ways you never know. So I was quite lucky to already have that network and to kind of lean more into it and pushing it, because the advice, the insight, and the connections that I got from the network were crucial for you know, the path in at least in my startup. And the fifth part is having an exit strategy. So I think everybody has an exit strategy, and they put like numbers and what they would like to get from the company, but that's not an exit strategy. An exit strategy is something that is very fluctuating, and that means that you have to understand what the market is looking like, how much runway you can get, and it's also understanding when to fold. There's a lot of companies that, you know, the VCs encourage them to go all the way in, and sometimes all the way in, and quite oftentimes means bankruptcy. And bankruptcy is not only, a sad thing for the founders because their path ends. It's a very sad thing for the people you've employed. And that was kind of like in my mind all the time. It's like, I have built a team. I've convinced them. I spent enormous amount of time to making sure that they come into this risky startup. And if we go bankrupt, or even if we start to scale down, I have to fire a lot of people. And that is something that was pushing me personally forward, of making sure that the company has longevity, whatever it means, whether it is through an exit, whether it is through more funding, whatever the situation. So understanding the market, understanding the market shifts in terms of financial market as well as the game market is imperative. But just to summarize, market research, team building, scaling smartly, the networking, the power of networking, as well as having an exit strategy, understanding when to fight, when to retreat. And the different part, like the what was different, what I didn't expect, and where I would invest more time, hindsight. Number one is really focusing on alignment of the leadership team. So going away as a CEO from that product thinking, more into like, I just need to make sure that this team of leadership thinks and feels exactly the same. Like, we can challenge each other, but as we walk out of this room, we tell the same story and we support each other in every single interaction. And kind of like focusing on that leadership team building and alignment between them is the most important part of a CEO or a head of studio in any organization. So that was something that I realized, in my opinion, too late. Not too late, but I should have had that from the beginning. And I think for the couple of years, I was just too much of a product thinking, like getting the product into the market and so forth. Number two is like slowing down the pace of communication. So, things come into your mind, especially I'm a super chatty cat. I like to throw ideas, kind of see how people interact with them. And that caused a lot of stress to people. And then you have to teach your leadership team to understand that, hey, like, not teach, but kind of explain, like, this is how I think. I like to think out loud. I like when you think out loud. And these are just ideas when we walk out of a room. It's not that we're pivoting or we're doing any kind of decision. We are just thinking out loud. This is nothing more. And so that is how I work. And I've had to like consciously really focus on slowing down the pace of communication, kind of understanding the tiers of communication, who are the L1s who I can talk about freely and just be myself, the chatty cat, who are the L2s who are like, you know, I need to convey a certain message, and who are L3 who are basically don't talk to but just listen. because like we had this, like Sophie was really instrumental in teaching me this. Like let's say I'm having a fun chat about UFOs, UFOs are every news and whatnot on a lunch table, and somebody's literally having this chat with me for the first time in like 3 months or in the team. And they would leave out thinking that all I think about is UFOs, where I've never even talked about UFOs except that one like fun lunch conversation where I just read a thing about like whatever, Captain Fravor saw a UFO. And it's just like, you know, like a fun little banter. And for them, it's like, this guy's all about UFOs. So understanding like who are you talking to and those, it's very important. So you can't be yourself all the time. But we have a podcast on that on Rise and Play. And then something that you mentioned, number three, is creating a structure in the process that allow you to scale. So that means everything from the values to virtues to mission to employee handbook, kind of making sure that this is how this company works. This is how this company doesn't work. And this is what we hire against. This is what we scale against. This is how we want to work week on week, month on month, year on year. And that has to be set because as you're bringing new people, they'll bring their own ways of working. If you haven't set the rules, you're kind of going to be all over the place and trying to please everybody. And final one, something that I should have invested much more time that I didn't realize, and something that I would urge every startup to do, is branding. Like your website, your how you're presented, all these things. What is the name of your company? Arguably Savage wasn't actually that good of an idea because it's quite off-putting for a lot of people. And it really didn't represent properly what we were. And we had like things where people would join like reluctantly, and they were like, this is nothing that my wife was worried about. Like people are super nice, very helpful. Like I was like, yeah, it's more like a mindset of a Savage. They're like, yeah, but like it's not helping. So these type of like when you're branding your company, really spend time, invest into it, make a great webpage because that's your storefront. You can't just slap something into it. Like, you can. But just slapping something into it, coming up with the first thing that you and your boys feel is a great name, or your gals, it doesn't have the longevity to it, and it will just misrepresent you, and then you will have to go back to it and so forth. So think about it. Think about your brand. Spend a good time. That's going to be everything that you're known on from the beginning. So just brand from the beginning. So yeah. Focus on alignment, slow down the pace of communication, create a structure and process, and brand.
I think that you brought up a lot of great lessons there. I think maybe a couple I can comment on are, one, to your point on networking, I think something that people don't do enough of, and one of the things that I felt fortunate to be able to do a year or two back was to create a tribe, basically a group of other folks. Like, so we've got like, now, at this point, 7 CEOs that talk about once a month, and we just bring, different kinds of topics that we talk about. And that's been a very, very helpful meeting for me in getting in, also helping in terms of network, because now it's like I've got the network of the combined group and just hearing what's happening, other people's perspectives, how different, really smart, like, much smarter than me. A lot of these guys are super successful, but understanding how they would think about different situations and things like that. So whoever you are, even if you're a product manager, getting 5 PMs from other companies that can provide different perspectives, and then bringing different topics every month. I think I kind of would agree with you that for me, having that tribe, in my opinion, is dramatically more valuable than going to GDC. So I'm not saying don't go to GDC, but I'm just saying like in terms of value, that's probably one of the biggest things that that I think a lot of people can tap into to help them in their careers and just become better at your craft. The one other comment I'll make in terms of some of the lessons that you've raised is your point on alignment of the leadership team. And I remember somebody had told me, somebody who was at Y Combinator, that that the biggest reason why startups fail are co-founder relationships and just like misalignment and problems between mm-hmm. co-founders. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to speak to some other founders where there's some pretty crazy stories out there about what could happen to co-founding teams. And, you know, I mean, it kind of sounds like you, Mishka, might be heading down eventually a path of going into investment. Well, we can talk about mm-hmm. that later. But like, one thing I have realized with all of my, you know, and not that, because we actually did not that many VC pitches, but I would say that nobody really dug into, and if that statistic is true, if 70% of teams fail, startups fail because of co-founder relationships, then where was the diligence on the co-founder relationships?
Yes. I got JK, you're nothing. Absolutely right.
Zero.
You're absolutely exactly. And this is what I realized. And even talking to investors who invested in our company, like a lot of the time the talk was almost exclusively about product.
Product,
market,
right? Not organization,
and, yeah, product. and a lot of like, okay, I'm not throwing shades on any VCs. I think yeah, VCs yeah. are amazing. I've yeah. been privileged to work with one of the best in the industry. A lot of the time, for some reason, they want to show that they are good VCs because they play so much games and they can give you game feedback. And it's like, that's not what I need. Like, I have a whole team that plays games and is for working on it. I found that I was very bad at showing my challenges with alignment and building. I didn't even know I had this sort of a challenge. If this normal, like I was very bad at talking about it because I felt ashamed that I wasn't able to align as effectively as need be. And I realized that then me kind of being the investor and talking to the investees is that now I start off by talking about the mistakes that I've done. The alignment mistakes and how we were able to fix certain things. I remember, you know, talking to one studio and they really turned the page around. And I just came in and was like, look, I'm a fuck up. Like, let me talk about all the mistakes that I did. And then here are the certain tools that we actually used to find an alignment, like mission cards for every person so that you understand the expectations of everybody. I think what investors are missing, this is what I'm kind of going through, is like what they're missing is like, if you tell me about your problems of similar experience, then I will tell you about my problems. If you don't tell me about your weaknesses, I'm not going to tell you that much about my weakness. I'm going to give you bullshit right. weaknesses about market and product, and we will talk about those. But I won't really talk about something that I might be a little bit of ashamed of, is the interpersonal challenges. I don't know if this is only me or this happening with other founders. But
sure
I need
coming.
Us to be, yeah, we need to be vulnerable to each other. Like, if you want to hear the true story, what's going on, I need you to be vulnerable. Because if you're the almighty, the smartest investor in the world, I need to look good in front of you. Like, just as a person, I can't talk about like, hey, I'm actually having a trouble with this person and I don't know how to talk to or like how to align or what kind of things. So I think you nailed it. I think there's a... most of the investors are very financially and market and product driven. And for some reason, even despite having their own founder experiences and having a lot of interpersonal challenges, choose not to talk about those and choose only to talk about the sort of fun stuff, the product.
Yeah. All right. So, two by two down, right?
Okay. Let's bring this baby home. We're over in an hour. So last one. This is an easy one. What is your why okay. and what are your personal values? I know you are one of the most driven and self-motivated person. You talk a lot about sacrifice. You don't talk about sacrifice. You sacrifice a lot. And I just want to understand like the sort of a why. And as well as like, have you identified your own personal values?
Yeah. Well, my why I kind of spoke about in answering the first question, which is like, yeah. I do want to try to be proud of my life and do something meaningful, whatever that is. And for me, it's, you know, opportunity, unlocking human potential, things like that. And hopefully have some success with that before I die. So that's my why. And as far as personal values, that's something I probably should think about more. Like, I have documented what I believe company values are, and I to some degree, those are a reflection or extension of some of my personal values. So, you know, I believe in direct communication. I believe in liberalism. I also believe in conservatism. So I'm like a liberal conservative. Although I also believe that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are not liberal or conservative.
No need to label. No need to label. Like, the fact is, like, I don't think you can, like, put yourself in this, because even if you put yourself in no matter what political party or even or other party, you're not liberal anymore, because now you're in a group thinking. And I think as a liberal, you mean you want to be open and form your own opinions based on different facts. And you don't have to – you can have a Republican opinion on certain things, and you can have a Democratic opinion on the other things. And I think you should be able to pick and choose rather than being in one party.
Yes. So personal values, open communication, directness, being efficient and effective. I don't believe in a lot of formality. I would say, you know, we also maybe something interesting to talk about is we have a, you know, we've documented a set of common values, which is kind of the principles by which we think we can be successful. But then we also have three operating principles that we talk about how we want to win. And so that's also kind of ties into a little bit of my personal values as well. But like these, the three operating principles are one, win with character, meaning, you know, we always want to be the good guys. We want to do the right thing. We want to be honest and operate with integrity and ethical behavior. Two, win with discipline, meaning we are a team that, because we suck so much, because, you know, we're a new team, we're not at that 4-year mark, we're building, and we have a lot of people that need to learn new skills. If we don't have discipline, I don't think we can win. And the third one is the one that trips people up, is we win with cruelty, right? So it's character, discipline, and cruelty, meaning ultimately we have to do what it takes to win. Now, we lead with character, but also we will do the things that are required in order for us, whether it's sacrifice or whether it's having a very direct conversation or whether it's, you know, telling someone in the company, you know, here's some feedback, you know, here are the things that you have to improve. You've got 60 days. If you don't, we're going to have to let you go. Something, things like that. So like, you know,
but that's not cruelty. I think you're being a bit hyperbolic, even with these, I think you're getting backlash because you're choosing, like, and this is coming from a person that named his company Savage. So, you know,
like, I'll also say that, you know, it's like some people, there are certain management, well, kind of tricks, right? I mean, like some people have heard of the shit sandwich for some junior people, you would give them a nice thing. And also there is a little bit of having to be hyperbolic to get, like, so let's say I want somebody to be here. I'll say this so that it's easier for them to get here. But, you know, so to some degree, I admit I am hyperbolic at times. But I do think that is an effective way of communicating at times to make a point to get you closer to where, again, I believe in trying to get people to change for the better. And sometimes it does serve to be hyperbolic at times.
Yeah. JK, cruelty is the wrong word to use. I'm just telling you straight up that I know what you mean. This is not what cruelty means. Your company is not cruel. You're not cruel. So let's word that a little bit.
I actually got this from, I don't know if
Blunt.
There are football fans in the U.S., but Michigan's head football coach is Jim Harbaugh. He used to coach at Stanford, completely turned the Stanford football program around. Like, it was like they had only won one game before Harbaugh came, and he turned them into a powerhouse. And he has this concept of, you know, we win with character, we win with cruelty. And, you know, so he would do things like when he was playing USC, they'd be up a lot and he'd go for 2 points. But, like, you know, anyway, but I do think there are winning with cruelty also just means that we're going to operate in a way where we just don't give a fuck what other people think. We're going to do things
which I understand.
Yeah.
It's just not the right word, because, like, you know what happens when you have a word like cruelty? You spend 5 minutes explaining what do you really mean by cruelty. And that means the word is a poor definition of what you're trying to say.
I'll think about that.
Yeah.
But it's also very memorable.
Yeah, but in a wrong way. Like, trust me. You don't want to be a cruel organization. You want to be, you know, direct, blunt. Those are both more objective words to describe what you're trying to do. Candor, radical, you know, that kind of stuff. But cruel is like, you don't want to write a leadership book of how to be cruel.
I will admit that there is a lot of value in the words that, to your point, in the words that you choose, and especially what I call framing, like how you frame the exact same situation, the exact same work, but the way you think about it can completely change your attitude and how you think about it. So I'll definitely admit that, like, how you characterize things or the specific words that you choose can have a big impact, for sure.
Yeah. Well.
Okay, my 3x3, my third question for you, Mishka. So you've done this startup. You've now recently left Sony.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next? And would you consider trying to start another game studio? Or I'm kind of getting the vibes, just so everyone knows, we haven't talked about this. I don't know. I haven't talked to Mishka in a long time. It's been a while, besides, you know, some messages on Instagram and things like that. Like, it kind of sounds like you're thinking VC is kind of the vibe I'm getting, but I don't know. What's next for you? What's going on in your mind about what's next? And then again, would you also consider like another startup or game studio?
Yeah. So what's next in terms of a short term? I don't know exactly. I promised myself to be kind of like chill and like, you know, kind of like wind down a little bit for a while. And lo and behold, I was till midnight talking to a bunch of people, like just, you know, friends who I haven't talked to in a long time, and then just like connecting and thinking about like what's next. But I had a coffee with a really, like, you know, tier one VC founder of that fund, general partner. He said, just take your time. Don't take a rebound job. That's, you know, when smart people give you advice, that's the thing. So I'm not going to rebound to any job. I'm going to focus on Deconstructor Fund. I'm going to help the studios that I've and the companies that I've invested in. You know, there's 16 or 17 of them. I even forgot how many. So whatever [S2] Nice. [S1] I can do to help them, whether it's visibility or whether it's advice, whether it's helping, you know, just listening, write a lot, you know, kind of like get back into a little bit of research, kind of like get my head out of the details and more into a macro level of the gaming industry. Maybe look at, you know, apps as well. Like I'm quite interested in like how apps have developed subscription services. I'm just spitballing, because there's a lot of things that I wanna do. I wanna write especially a lot more and do podcasts and talk. But nice. But what do you think I should do next?
Well, I think to some degree it would go back to your own question about what is your why, right? And so my recommendation would be, if you spend this time really thinking about, for you, so you imagine, you know, you're on your deathbed looking back on your life, what would make you feel the most proud?
Yeah. That's an excellent question. And I've thought about my own values as well, and my why and what makes me really happy, and helping others makes me really happy. I'll give an example. This is a very broad way to talk about. Like I'm not particularly altruistic, if that what it means. But when we do these Deconstructor Fun events, especially the big ones with Google, like 1,000 people come in. You'll be there next year. You'll see. So many people come to me and say how certain articles have helped them. They show me like pictures that they've printed out, how it helped them to start their company and get to where they are, and like right. really successful people, like from great companies. And that makes me very happy. Like I've got no money from that, nothing, but it's just like, oh, I was able to help people at scale. People come to me like, hey, I got to this company by just reading your deconstruction, and I didn't really know much about mobile gaming, and I read it, and now I'm like head of this and that in this company. Like, thank you so much. That makes me so happy. You know, like from the inside, it just feels so great. And there's no monetary right. things tied to that. It's just, it's just like seeing the faces and seeing people just genuinely appreciate what you've done and how you've given back to the industry. I'm quite proud of that. I'll be honest. It's just like, it's, you know, I've put in a lot of years, a lot of like crazy hours to publish all kinds of deconstructions and market research and stuff like that with no money, nothing, just sharing it and learning myself and seeing that effect. So what's next to me is like, that makes me happy. That makes me feel fulfilled. And as I said, my why for a startup was always to learn how to help founders better. And mm-hmm. I would like to leverage that knowledge. I'll take my time. I'll decompress. I'll write a lot. I kind of like get the insights that I can really, really from this experience, formulate how I want to help it. But I think helping at scale, whatever that is, whether it is inside of a company, or whether it is, in a fund or another context, that's going to continue. And I would also not consider taking a break from Deconstructor Fun anymore, because I think that's I realize such a big part of me in the sense how absolutely. I learn, like having these conversations is invaluable for me. It's cathartic, if you will. and those are the kind of things. But I'm lucky that I don't have to have the answer right now, and I'm very, very blessed to have the time to think and formulate rather than having to jump into the next thing.
So I assume I'll be seeing you at a venture fund in the next year or so.
I don't know, but let's say that if that happens, that wouldn't be out of character. And, I love helping founders.
And actually what you're doing with Deconstructor, like, The new venture investors are social media brands to yes. some degree, right? That's just the new reality of the world we live in. So
it's a free marketing platform, and we do a lot of things. But yeah, the question is like, would I start a new studio? Of course, that crosses my mind every week. The fucking what is that game that is booming on Steam? Four people made it. BattleBit. Like these type of things. And I'm almost like picking up a phone and calling somebody like, dude, have you played this game? It's like, what? And I was like, dude, chill. And, you know, like we feels there's always that feeling of unfinished business. While I worked on games that, you know, there are massive franchises, I never actually built a massive franchise. I've had so many games fail in soft launch that it's ridiculous. And I think I've had so many failures that I'm not anymore thinking of myself of like, I could do it. But there are days where I'm like, I could do it. so then you have to always go back. It's like, is that what you want? Is that what make you happy? Or is it helping people, helping others to achieve that, helping maybe 10 companies to get to that right. phase? Would that make you more happier than you are the one who made it? And honestly, the 10 others that will make it, though they will be 100x more successful than I am financially and whatnot, will make me more happier and more fulfilled than if I were the one who would grind that game out. And I think you're correct. I think I'll be on the other side of the table telling about all my mistakes and hoping that they would help that particular founder in their current stage.
Got it. All right. Well, I think we got through this, Mishka. 3x3. Interesting format. Good idea. We'll see if people like it or not.
So I want to just finish it by saying, do not send JK hate mail. like he's a good dude, and he's doing a lot of sacrifices.
Okay. It helps drive me.
It's not okay. He's a person. He's flying like 26 hours on a coach to Bangalore to make a game for y'all to play, and if he has certain opinions of ways of working, those are his opinions, and he's not against your opinions. So you can have a debate with him, but don't call him a fucking idiot, because he's not. He's a hardworking family man who's just trying to make a fun game.
Appreciate that, Pishka. And yeah, I guess to end it, we can just end it here. It was great talking to you again, Mishka. You guys have now experienced the OG pod with the new format, because we got some old dogs trying new tricks, 3x3. And we'll do something again, Mishka.
Comment people in below some of the questions, some anything. Like, we love seeing comments, we love answering those. So whether it will be in JK in his own pod, whether it will be on my own platform, or whether we'll do again something together, because people have been messaging, bring back JK, bring back the old crew. We never know. We might bring back JK. We never intentionally separated. JK was just at one day said, peace out. And we're like, okay. You never even gave a reason. So I did not kick out JK, just for the for clarity. He just left.
Yeah, I mean, I talked about it on the pod, but yeah, it's all good, and we should definitely do more collabs, and keep this rolling.
All right, JK, all right. I'll see you in Istanbul, the latest.
All right, we'll talk about that. All right, so for the audience, we'll catch you guys next time. Bye, everybody.